podcast this week, we grab hold of the Infinity Gauntlet and use it to compel directors Anthony and Joe Russo to talk to us about Avengers Infinity War. Plus, all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I can't believe Thanos got two away goals. Could prove crucial in the second leg. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, which once again this week is brought to you by those wonderful chaps and chapeaus at Sky Cinema, the dedicated home for movie lovers. Later in the show, I'll be pointing out a couple of movies that you can watch on Sky Cinema, just two from the array of films, over 1,000, that are available on demand on Sky Cinema, including a brand new premiere every single day of the week. How exciting. Now, this week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, and also doubling up this week as the queen of squee. Dear God. Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very tired because I went to see a midnight screening.
Oh, you did the midnight screening?
I did the midnight screening.
Okay, I bailed on a midnight screening.
You were possibly wise. Last Do you know night. What? Cinemas that decide to show the full range of adverts and nonsensical little rubbish inter bits that they've made themselves before a midnight screening should be shot. I mean,
cinemas should be shot.
Cinemas themselves should. Okay, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I'm sleep deprived because I had to sit up for 25 minutes after yeah. midnight, which yeah. is already like 2 hours after my bedtime.
Yes.
Watching, you know, ridiculous ads for nothing.
Yeah. Oh. What was your favourite advert? We'll get into it later.
I don't have any favourite adverts because I refuse them all. And if I see any of them, I will refuse to buy them, even if I want them.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. Jimbo Dyer.
Hello.
The who, as I so correctly say, is our West Wing guru and king of, well, not so much squee, as more of like a kind of existential... but not in relation to the film we're talking
about. No, not at
just
all.
Just in general, you have a very meh attitude towards life. You, how can I say this without being insulting, drain the life from me.
I do.
Thank God you find a non-insulting way to say that.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. That's touching.
You didn't go see Avengers at midnight?
I did not go and see it at midnight, but I did see it on the Tuesday night and then again with you immediately following that.
Not immediately.
The Wednesday morning.
Because immediately would have been 10 o'clock
that's
that
night. That's true. I mean, it was very difficult for me to go to the screening knowing that I was missing the Liverpool Roma game. and obviously I was checking the score throughout the film. Yep. To make sure that us Reds they might have been in an away kit. I don't know. What's their other kit? What's the other colour? Is it red? Is the Who? Other one red? Liverpool. When they play away, what colour do they play?
Oh, well, this season they play away in a sort of green and white combination.
A simple one-word answer with a colour would be fine.
Or the third kit is a beautiful orange
hang
number.
On. Third kit.
Hang on. So, green, white and orange.
So they have a home kit, they have an away kit, and they have a third kit for Sunday Best.
So what happens is if you are playing a team that has red and you're away from home, you can't wear something that clashes with them. And if they have white on their kit as well or green on their kit, which is very unlikely, then you can use your... That's when you use your third kit.
Yeah, so they use the reality kit mainly and then they have the time kit for when they visit people.
Well, and the power kit. The power kit is very important.
And believe me, it was... as people will know who've been listening to the podcast the last couple of weeks, I had a dilemma. Do I watch Avengers Infinity War for the first time or do I watch Liverpool play Roma in the first leg of the Champions League semi-final? As it turned out, I really did neither. because the gods scheduled a phone interview directly against both. And so I watched half an hour of the Liverpool game because the phoner ran really late.
And ironically, I went to see Infinity War with David Morrissey, so that was fun.
he was loving it.
If there are any Disney security people listening, I would like to make clear that that James was not actually checking his phone.
Yeah. No, he wasn't.
Not least because I don't care.
But, can I just say, Jimbo, it was really, really helpful of you to actually film Infinity War for us.
So that you could watch it afterwards.
And send it to me.
No, you're welcome.
I felt it lost a little something. I could hear people like chewing popcorn and stuff. And then a big burly bloke came across and asked you to,
Yeah.
No, of course not.
And that
the
was
Empire
Thanos.
Podcast, the Empire Podcast does not condone piracy. Video piracy is a crime.
Do not accept it.
If you know anyone who pirates a video, dob them in because you can get up to a grand.
Oh, really? Ew, no.
Yeah, that's how I paid my way through university. Anyway, welcome both. Should we have a question?
Yes.
Certainly.
Please. Here's a good question. This is from Liono32 via the medium of Twitter.
Don't get enough Thundercats writing into the podcast.
He says, Schnarf! He says, with the Infinity War premiere having just taken place, what's your favourite ever movie premiere experience, taking into account celeb encounters, audience reception, freebies, excitement, etc.? We may be the wrong people to ask, because... Yeah. By and large, we don't go to movie premieres, at least not anymore.
Well, mainly we don't get invited, but...
Yeah, I mean, and who can blame them?
But also, we've already seen the films, and oftentimes, this is the worst kind of my diamond shoes are two type situation.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be an incredible amount of...
I mean, it's just, I know I'm the worst person alive for saying this, but they're a pain in the arse because you have to sit in your seat waiting for the celebrities to arrive. So you're maybe seated for like an hour before the film starts, and it'd be allocated seating, so you can't like pick a really good seat. You're just at the mercy of whatever seat you're given.
And let's be honest, even if we're invited, we're given quite bad seats.
Yeah,
because we're not very important.
Whereas like when we went to the Infinity War Multimedia, we were there like two hours before the doors opened, and we got the best seats in the house.
We did.
I was planning to queue up from 3 p.m.
I bet you were.
I was there at 3 p.m.
Were you there at 3 p.m.?
Mm-hmm.
And people were ahead of you?
Yes, fans who were at the fan screening. Mm-hmm. And there were only four of them ahead of me, and then they all had friends. So then there were 20 people ahead of me.
I turned up about 8:30 and then used the Eye of Agamotto to sort of go back in time and get a good seat. It was useful.
All right.
Favourite premiere experience? Well, Helen and I have an advantage / disadvantage here in that we have both spent many hours in the trenches covering premieres for the website in our
back
early days.
Back in the day.
And I have done so many premieres.
I mean, one of the most memorable was the Bridget Jones Edge of Reason premiere, because the red carpet flooded, because it rained so much.
Not Fiji.
And it was, it was sort of standing in kind of ankle deep, slightly soapy water because they'd washed the carpet just before they brought it out. So that was unfun.
I recall something similar. It wasn't the first and possibly only premiere, Chris, that you covered for us was Spider-Man. Uh-huh. And you and I did it, and we had a similar situation where there was running water flowing over our feet as we stood on the carpet. Do you not remember it?
No.
That was pretty brutal.
I remember you both doing the BAFTAs one year and you chasing Kurt Russell, shouting, "Snake, snake, I thought you were dead."
Yes. He wouldn't stop, and I was, that was funny.
What was the last premiere you went to?
I went to Jason Bourne. I don't remember. I probably went to one since then, but I can't remember. Jason Bourne's the last one I actually recall going to.
Okay.
But the only LA premiere I went to was Watchmen with you, which was quite exciting as an LA premiere.
Yes, that was fun.
Legitimately studded with famous and semi-famous people.
We were sitting just in front of Hero from Heroes, weren't we?
Yes, we were. Yeah, Masioka.
So star-studded.
Yeah, it was star-studded. But and Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, I had to be there 10 hours before the doors opened because that was insanity. It was the whole Sunday.
The best premiere that clinched it for me was... The Deathly Hallows Part 2. So they took over every cinema in Leicester Square, certainly every big one. And they also took over Trafalgar Square, which is where the red carpet was. Now, I wasn't working that, but we had to walk through Trafalgar Square's red carpet, up that whole way. If you've ever come, if you know London, you're coming up past the, through the middle, essentially, of the National Gallery, up that road through the middle under the bridge. And they had Death Eaters there that you could get your picture taken with. They had like a bit of Diagon Alley under the bridge.
Cool.
They had owls that you could hold. I've got a picture of me holding an owl. And then you go up the carpet again into the square and get into your seat. And there were kids, there were sort of barriers on either side of the that bit of the walk just to get people moving fast to the square. And there were kids lying on the ground, sticking their head under the barriers and just grinning like they were having a lovely time just because they might see some famous people on the way. And of course, there were famous people at that because it was such a big deal. And we got invited to the party, which had like... cauldrons full of sweets and fortune tellers and a band with Tonks playing lead.
Did you at any point
full on
pat your pockets theatrically and then go Axio tickets? No,
no,
okay,
no, I did not.
Didn't Will Smith? He did a, I believe it was iRobot. He did a gig, big
he
Willy
did.
Style in
the
Leicester Square.
Yeah, that was good. He raised the bar there on that one because I felt like Tom Cruise coming and doing like 4.5 hours of autograph signing was one thing. Will Smith coming and doing like 3 hours of autograph signing plus a
plus
concert.
A gig, yeah.
you know, it's
but it's
cool.
Funny because when we started doing this, so I started doing Premier coverage in 2000, and they were quite understated affairs. Like, it would just be, you know, there'd be a few people outside, you know, you'd go in and you'd stand in the foyer and you'd normally have a chat with whoever was in the film. Like, it was quite like, you know, one-on-one. Sometimes you'd even sit down for a coffee with them before the film started. Like, it was really random, certainly for the smaller premieres. And then Tom Cruise turned them into this monstrous event because he spent so much time working the crowd and walking out. Then everyone started doing it and it turned into these huge three-ring circus things.
That's why we've never had him on the podcast. Every time he tries to come on, he spends 4 hours outside signing autographs. And we're like, Tom, we don't have any time for you. Gotta go.
I mean,
sorry,
he keeps
man.
Asking to come back and we're just like, no.
Begging.
Don't want you.
Begging.
It's not happening.
Yeah, it's undignified, actually. It's an up-and-down pride-swallowing siege that he will never fully tell you about.
My favourite premiere is Expendables 2.
Oh my god!
Starring a good old chum.
That's right, because I was Arnold's date to the premiere. It's when I was doing the feature on him, and I did my interview with him took me up the red carpet. I was interviewing him.
I beg your pardon?
It's not a euphemism. I was interviewing him as we walked up the red carpet with a sort of phalanx of security around both of us.
Right.
And kind of, I'm talking to him as he's signing autographs and stuff, people screaming, shouting, whatnot. And right. As we're about to walk into the cinema, this is the Empire Leicester Square, and as we were about to walk in, for the life of me, I don't remember what particularly first-based insipid question I asked him, but he stopped and he turned. And he stopped what he was doing and answered at length while in the doorway holding up the entire queue of people trying to go in. There's loads of photographers taking pictures. I've never felt so self-conscious in my entire life. And I went, no, God, can we please go inside? This is embarrassing.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
But yeah, it was nuts.
Did you say to him, Arnold, I'll just go run and put some bags and seats for us. I'll save you good seats.
I'll give you good seats. Yeah, it was fun.
That's incredible. What was the last one you went to, Helen?
Murder on the Orange Express, I think.
Murder.
That was at the Royal Albert Hall, wasn't it?
It was at the Royal Albert Hall, but it was, you know, all of the cast were there and it was very sort of starry and fancy, which is to say that I completely avoided the red carpet in that case and went in the back door and just went straight to my seat and watched it all on the screen, which, you know, I could have done.
But that's
from
thing.
An internet cafe.
Like, one of the most exciting things ever was when the extent I went to blag Force Awakens premiere tickets. I thought this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's going to be the greatest premiere of all time. And I saw no one because all of it happened outside and all you did was see footage on the screens. No one came in. We didn't see anyone. I could have been at home. I mean, it was a massive anticlimax.
Amazing. I've got a couple.
Yeah.
I've got a couple real quick. So I've been lucky enough to host a couple of premieres, which is a really interesting, surreal experience. The best one, the one that really sticks in my mind, is the Alan Partridge movie premiere, Alan Partridge Alpha Papa, which was in Norwich.
Of course.
And so I went out to Norwich and they flew Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge in that blue safari suit. You could probably Google it. He's wearing that Roger Moore safari suit from The Spy Loved Me, but in very Partridgian blue. And that was great because he was in character and I had to like pump up the crowd for like 2 hours and get them, you know, like, are you excited about Alan Partridge? And loads of people. And it was in a car park, an NCP car park. It was amazing. And he was fantastic. So that was a lot of fun. I also did the Cowboys versus... Is it Cowboys and Aliens?
Cowboys and Aliens.
Cowboys and Aliens premiere.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this?
That.
Yes. Big screen. So we hosted the premiere of Cowboys and Aliens, and so I hosted that. And I'll never forget this. Daniel Craig comes in, and I'm quite nervous because I've hosted stuff before, but I've never hosted a premiere on this scale before, but I was shitting my pants, frankly. And so Daniel Craig comes in, and he comes up to me, and we do the interview, and it's all very, very lovely. And then as he goes off, I notice that this young kid standing next to us, like 4 or 5 years old, who's been shouting, Daniel, 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 all the way through. And Daniel Craig hasn't noticed him. So I go, oh, Daniel, on the mic. I go, Daniel, there's this little kid here who's been shouting your name. Oh, you must want to go up and say something to him. And Daniel Craig, on mic, goes up and says hello to this kid. And the kid immediately bursts into tears. Like, full kind of, ah! And it's just a horrible moment. I'm just like, Daniel Craig, everybody! Like James Bond has just made this kid cry.
That's amazing.
It was absolutely horrendous. And then, of course, it's the premiere. I will not name the film or the people involved. Where a producer of a quite large-scale blockbuster, shall we say, hit on me in front of my then girlfriend, now wife.
Wow.
That was fun.
Still got it.
Still got it. I was young and cute back then.
You know, speaking of being young and cute, my very first day at Empire, I was at the High Fidelity premiere. That was my very first day.
Really?
Yeah, I had to cover it that evening.
My first full day was the Peter Pan premiere, the one with Jason Isaacs.
Yes.
I went to that.
Hello to him.
I saw Dave Gilmore and didn't go up to him. There's a theme at running through all these premieres. I see famous people and then don't go up to them.
But that's normally a good thing, because I, obviously being my first day, didn't know what I was doing. And at the party, I went up to Samantha Morton, which of course at the party is an immediate, you don't do that. You don't randomly walk up to celebrities and start asking them questions. I didn't have a recorder and I asked her a question and she gave me an answer. And I spent so long writing it down, when I looked up, she walked off. Bless.
Amazing.
How naive I was.
I often wonder what would happen if I'd actually slept with that producer.
Well, think of what you could have achieved.
I know. Think of the things I could have done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd rather not. just not going to.
It was amazing. Anyway. There we go. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast, and why wouldn't you? You could do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmperorMagazine. Use the hashtag Emperor podcast. We're on Facebook as well as Emperor Magazine. And you can, of course, email us podcast@empireonline.com. Got a bit of a cold this week, so my voice is quite deep. Super villainy. I will kill all the baddies.
You're just trying to copy Thor. We know it.
I am not. I still am not. Anyway, should we talk about some movie news?
Let's do it. Yes.
Let's do this thing. What's been happening in the world of the movies?
Some exciting trailers this week. I recommend having a look at the one for Crazy Rich Asians, which is a very entertaining book and looks like being a very entertaining film.
There was another one, wasn't there?
I was trying to lead in.
Sorry.
Break it easily,
Sorry.
Right? So first of all, the good news. That was Crazy Rich Asians. and then there's a full trailer for Venom, which gives us, I guess, a little bit more of an idea of what they're going for with Venom, which appears to be a late 1990s superhero movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
The sequel to Spawn that nobody asked for. It seems to be what they've
I love the fact that the final reveal of Venom has become a meme. This has become a whole thing. And I like to think that Elizabeth Banks kicked this off with her still of it, where she just responded like, "It looks like he's eating a dick." bless her.
Do you know what else it looks like? And I don't think this is a spoiler. It's in the trailers. I think he looks like the baddie army of faceless goon dog things in Infinity War.
A little bit.
And not brilliant news. But it does seem to be another film with basically, you know, Tom Hardy and a funny voice.
It does.
Not his funny voice, I think.
I know, I'm still convinced that's Lance Reddick. He's not credited, but I am absolutely convinced Lance Reddick is the voice of Venom. I would swear blind to this.
Well, I mean, you're not going to turn that gig down, are you?
No.
I mean, that's a belter. this is, yeah, we say this a lot on the Emperor podcast, that every day is Christmas Eve.
Every day.
And we treat every film as if it's a wonderful present just waiting to be unwrapped under the tree. But now and again, just like a National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, you have a doddery old relative who maybe accidentally sticks green jello into a package and wraps it instead, and also wraps her cat, and you just know that present when you shake it up and down and bits of green jello, I'm saying jello because that's what they say in the film, leaks all over you, and then the cat goes meow! You know that present is not going to be that great. And I'm not saying that Venom's going to be a terrible film, but the chances are quite high.
But you are saying you've got jello in your fingers right
I've now got, yeah. I've got jello in one hand and cat fur in the other, and I'm not happy. This looks like a movie composed almost entirely of first takes. So far, it looks monumentally misjudged, and I'm not entirely sure. And every day is Christmas Eve, and I just think that they should just stop. I think they should just stop now.
Like we said with the casting, though, right? We kept being like, we don't want a Venom movie. This sounds like a terrible idea.
Yes.
And then all of these really good people signed up, and we were like, maybe there's something there. Maybe they know something that we do not know.
It's been very artfully hidden, if so.
Yes.
I mean, the effects look not great.
They don't.
But that's sometimes the case for trailers.
But
you know?
You also have a character, Venom, whose entire existence in comics and his entire creation is predicated on Spider-Man. It's the reason why he looks like Spider-Man. His reason why his abilities mimic Spider-Man's. He bases everything off his psychopathy, and his whole raison d'etre, certainly through the first years of the character's existence, was about wanting to eat the spider. That's it. That's how he came into being. And if you're making this movie, and I know there's reasons why that it's not going to be a full-on Spider-Fest, it just strikes me as maybe a little misjudged. But, you know, hey, Christmas Eve. I'm excited.
Yes.
I'm excited. I'm excited to watch this movie for all sorts of reasons. What else has happened?
Oh, some good cartoon news, or animation news, I should say. there is going to be a sequel to Chicken Run.
That was unexpected.
Aardman's working on it. Now, this was a box office smash, but it was a smash back in 2000.
Yes. Before Mel Gibson was Mel Gibson.
Yeah, and you know, we left his character Rocky and Julia Sawala Ginger coupled up and presumably living happily ever after on an island. So it could just be completely new characters. This could be Chicken Run, the next generation, if you will. But it's directed by Sam Fell, who did Flushed Away and Paranorman for Laika. So I'm interested. Yeah, I do too. So I'm interested to see more because I think that's promising. Also in slightly related animation news, Laika, the other great stop-motion animation studio, is pushing ahead with film number 5. They're calling it for the moment film 5. And we're told that Chris Butler is directing a globe-trotting comedy adventure bursting with humour, heart and a profound message of acceptance and finding one's place, which is, like, fine. Hugh Jackman, Zoe Saldana and Zach Galifianakis are heading the voice cast for that one.
Oh, my word.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's huge news.
I'm very happy.
Huge of true.
Unsurprising news of the day. A Quiet Place is officially getting a sequel.
Mm-hmm. What?
Who'd have thought? Film that makes shitloads of money. Get sequel, shocker.
Is it A Quiet Place 2, Run Silent, Run Deep?
Is it is. They did mention submarines. Yep. That's now canon.
I want some goddamn money. I want some cheddar.
I assume Krasinski will have some kind of producing role in this. I would be surprised if his involvement goes beyond that, but you never know.
A notion of what the story of the sequel should be before he started making this one.
And what was that?
He didn't tell me.
Is it about people trying to keep quiet?
It's about people trying to keep quiet. Well, of course, like we've only seen obviously a tiny, tiny corner of this world, very deliberately and very, very consciously, and we've only seen a tiny, tiny fragment really of time. I think it was basically picking up where that one left off.
I think it's going to be set on a planet where there's no sound and no light. Uh-huh. And it's going to be the Space Bastards versus the giant moths from Pitch Black. And we're going to see who wins.
Right, Diesel. It could be a Riddick film. I think it's going to be the tragic tale of a one-man band who blunders into a peanut packing factory. Uh-huh. And it's a very short film.
It's a really short film. Extremely short, yes.
I mean, I don't even think it gets to the credit sequence, I'll
no,
be honest with you.
I don't either.
Dead.
It's lucky none of those people got a cold at any point. Anyway.
It is, isn't it? They would have, you know, one sneeze and you're gone.
Toast.
Yeah. That's your poster line for you there. Possibly related to A Quiet Place. So J.J. Abrams has gone on record saying his Overlord is not a Cloverfield movie. Now, this could be truth. Or it could simply be the Cloverfield Paradox wasn't very well received, and this Quiet Place standalone thing's done really well, so maybe we should uncouple this.
Overlord isn't a Cloverfield
film. It's a John
Harrison film.
Exactly. So apparently it's not. But J.J. Abrams, as we all know, is absolutely honest and absolutely never misleads his audiences by trying to keep secrets, so who knows?
Well, we do, because he's absolutely honest, apparently.
He is.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Of course, The Cloverfield Paradox wasn't a Cloverfield film until about 5 minutes before it came out, apparently. So who knows? I'm excited about this. One of the great unmade Stephen King stories might actually be made. It is The Long Walk, which is a Richard Bachman story, which is the pen name that King took for a while. In fact, still does from time to time. And it's a really... It's a dystopian tale. There's a lot of Hunger Games in there, a lot of Running Man as well. It's about a future in which there is a competition called The Long Walk. A group of young guys basically have to keep walking. That's it. Oh, yeah, that's right. But if they stop walking, they get killed. And if they slow down beneath a certain pace, they get killed.
Huh.
So it's until only one person's left. Really grueling, really fantastic novella by Bachman / King. I think Frank Darabont had the rights to it for a long time but couldn't crack the nut. But now James Vanderbilt, who is the screenwriter of Zodiac, he is attached to write that. And so I'm very, very excited about that because we've had some really good King adaptations on the big screen recently and, of course, The Dark Tower as well. So fingers crossed it is closer to the likes of It and Gerald's Game.
Amen.
Yeah.
Men.
Have you seen that they're doing a Fast and Furious animated series?
Yeah, you know.
Starring Tony Toretto, Dom's teenage cousin. I shit you not.
Is this the same cousin we meet in Fast and Furious 8 on the exotic island of Cuba?
It's unclear to me.
Okay.
But this is a thing that is happening.
And there's not a lot we can do to stop it.
No.
Apparently not. Amy Adams has signed up for Joe Wright's The Woman in the Window, which sounds like a Rear Window-esque thriller. So that'll be an interesting turn for her. I wonder if there's more to it, but we don't know yet.
It's a remake, isn't it?
Yeah. Harrison Ford will be in the Secret Life of Pets sequel. So that's a thing.
Mm. That is a thing. CinemaCon's been happening in Las Vegas this week, so there's been lots of movie news and lots of first looks of stuff coming out from there. We weren't there because we're here, but I'm very excited because M. Night Shyamalan unleashed, unveiled the first footage from Glass, which is a movie I'm tremendously excited about, and it looks pretty good. And apparently there's a trailer which may be hitting the web soon.
Ooh.
Sounds to me like it, you know, there's no reason for it not to. And it seems that the basic plot of it all is that Sarah Paulson plays a psychiatrist who is probing into people, not that way, who think that they're superheroes. And of course, she happens upon her patients. Three of her patients are Mr. Glass, Sam Jackson, Kevin Wendell Crumb, James McAvoy, and David Dunn, Bruce Willis, who all do have powers to an extent, apart from Mr. Glass, who's just one of the more cerebral bad guys.
Yeah, he's like Brainiac.
Yeah,
ish.
With his brittle bones and whatnot, I guess. Mm. But that's a terrible power to have. So, yeah, I'm really excited about this film. I cannot wait to see it.
Do you think at any point David Dunn will turn to the camera and go, Glass? Who gives a shit about Glass? No?
I hope so. I'm not the one who just got butt-fucked on national TV, Kevin Wendell Crumb.
Shoot the glass.
There we go.
What you got to do?
It's all connected.
It's all connected. The BWCU.
Fantastic. Right, that's it for the news.
Yay.
Is that it for the news?
I think it is.
Are we happy?
I mean, we're super happy.
How do we feel? Let's rate the news out of 10 this week.
Seven?
I mean, I would say about a 6, to be honest. Well, no, there's Leica in there. So, like, yeah, that'll take it up to a 7.
Yeah, I kind
of... There's venom in there. Takes it back down to 6.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so as you know, this week's podcast is sponsored by Sky Cinema, which gives you unlimited access to the best movies at home, whenever, and wherever you want in the best possible way. I have been a Sky Cinema subscriber for many years now, many, many wonderful years, and I love the choice they offer. Like I said, over 1,000 quality movies on demand, ready for me or you or anybody to enjoy whenever I or you or they want. This week, my recommendations are both from the premiere section of Sky Cinema. First up is Jordan Peele's brilliant, groundbreaking, Oscar-winning Get Out, in which Daniel Kaluuya goes to visit his girlfriend's parents and ends up getting a lot more than he bargained for. It's part Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, part Stepford Wives, yet wholly original. It's one of the best horror debuts in recent years, with a fantastic script that is razor sharp about race in modern America and packs in plenty of thrills, gore, and this being Jordan Peele of Key and Peele fame, gags as well. Get in. Then we have Life, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Rebecca Ferguson, and Ryan Reynolds as astronauts aboard the ISS. That's the International Space Station for you guys. And they're battling an alien creature, which sounds obviously so far so alien, but it is one of the best alien-inspired sci-fi horrors in years. Got a quality cast, a great, memorable monster, a smart script by Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who also work with Ryan Reynolds on the Deadpool movies, and an absolute belter of an ending. Check it out. So those are my recommendations for this week's Sky Cinema, and join me next week for more Sky Cinema-related fun. Okay, time now for this week's guests. They are the directors of what will most likely be the year's biggest film in terms of box office, although Jurassic Kingdom Fallen World might have something to say about that, and almost certainly the biggest film of all time in terms of sheer mind-boggling scale. They are Joe and Anthony Russo, directors of Captain America the Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, and now Avengers Infinity Squee. No, she didn't do it. Now, ordinarily, we would have done a spoiler special with these guys when they came to London a few weeks ago, but because they made a decision not to show the movie to anybody, not even their good old pod buddies, Empire, until just 2 days before it came out, and you'll know why when you see the film, we were unable to do so. We're still working on that. We still hope to do that down the line. But for this, I decided to dig a little more into who they are as directors, how they work together, and what they've got planned post-Marvel. So it's not really Avengers-focused, but hey, most of you by now will have already seen the film. Hope you enjoy. Here's Joe Russo and Anthony Russo. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the directors of Avengers Infinity War, Joe Russo, Anthony Russo. How are you both?
Good, how are you? How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Do you know what day it is? Are you still in that sort of post-film, middle of the other film haze, or are you okay?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we've ever, run out of the digital internegative and a sound mix the way that we did, to get on a plane with our bags. So they're like, yep, looks great. Okay, great, final, that shot's final. That I did. The mix is great, here we go. And then jumped in a car and drove to the airport. So we literally, delivered the movie seconds before we left for this press tour.
You're showing 20 minutes of footage, which I saw.
That's right.
Which I saw today. So I haven't seen the finished film. So ordinarily, we'd be doing a spoiler special.
Yes.
And hopefully we will do that down,
for sure,
down the line.
We look forward to that.
But my theory is that you actually forgot to finish the film.
It's a good theory.
Is there anything you left out of the film? Now looking back going, we forgot to put Hulk in. Guys, we need to go back.
No, fortunately we had a very thorough prep period on this movie, so I think we would have caught a mistake that big, hopefully. Who knows?
All right, okay. Because does that explain Hawkeye? It wasn't saying, we forgot Hawkeye!
Wait a minute, hold on.
Hawkeye wasn't sort of forgotten.
We did forget something.
Oh no, we need to go back and put it back in again.
And who plays him again?
I think it's the Belgian actor, Jeremy Renier.
That's right, yes, that's right. Two-time Academy Award nominated Jeremy Renner that apparently the fans think that we forgot.
He's lurking.
Yeah.
He's lurking somewhere.
It will all be explained.
All right.
In due
fantastic.
Time.
But how do you feel at the end? Because you're not at the end of this process. You are halfway through?
Yeah, we're about halfway through the process. Yeah. I mean, literally, as soon as we finish this press tour, we go back and start cutting Avengers 4, which we have very little time to complete because the special effects are ginormous on that movie as well, and special effects take months to cook.
Yeah.
So we got to get to work right away.
So that's not going to be a sort of My Dinner with Andre type chamber piece where it's just Tony and Thanos just...
We can only dream.
Just chilling.
We can only dream.
They cook for each other.
Now that would be amazing. We can talk about breaking this movie, because this is an astonishing film to break. Right. I mean, in terms of the moving parts, I don't think there's a major blockbuster out there like it, and certainly has been for a long, long time. I'm thinking maybe something like A Bridge Too Far, going way, way back.
Right.
In terms of breaking down the pieces and knowing which characters you wanted to pair off, which characters you wanted to put into groups, did that take a long time to come to terms with?
It took months.
To decide, yeah.
I mean, we sit in a room about this size, which is, a medium-sized bedroom. And we don't sit in a medium-sized bedroom. We're actually in a medium-sized bedroom right now at a hotel doing this podcast. But we have magnetic whiteboards, dry erase whiteboards on the wall. We have...
I have the same in my bedroom.
Yeah, we have little magnets with every character in the Marvel Universe on it. We put them up on the dry erase board, and then we just start talking. It's me, Anth, Marcus, and McFeely, and we spend months in a room writing ideas under each magnet, talking about each character, where they could go, what we want them to do, what we want to see happen to them, what we think would be interesting or surprising, where they are at this point in the Marvel Universe and where we want them to go after this. We talk about the villain, we talk about the agenda, and then you start lining up all of those things slowly and coalescing that into a plot. And then, what we'll do is then we write cards out for the plot. So we'll do, each theme will be a card, and we'll put that up on the board, and then we spend 2 or 3 months just going through the cards, looking at the structure. Is that the correct scene? Can we do a better scene? Is that leading to the ending correctly? Once we're done with that, so now we're about 5 or 6 months into the process, it's ready for a script to be written.
So where do you start? Do you start with the end? Do you have an end in sight?
No,
it depends.
It depends. We could start anywhere, really. We just start to grab threads, things that we find sort of interesting or combustible, ideas that we have, and start shaping around it.
We did know the end. I think that both Avengers 3 and 4, pretty early on, we came up with the idea of what we wanted to do and then ran at it. And I think that was helpful in unifying the characters. It was helpful for us as a, knowing where we were heading to on the map.
Because there were so many characters, it was helpful in, giving us a target to get everybody to, so to speak.
This process started at what, in relation to Civil War, at what point? Were you doing this immediately? Were you doing this during Civil War?
Civil War. There came a point when, Civil War, it was such a good setup for Thanos, so to speak, in the sense that the Avengers would become divided.
Yeah.
And then they would face the greatest threat they have ever faced in Thanos. So that just got us thinking as the movie was coming together in post, it's, you know, our thoughts started to naturally go toward, okay, well, what is that threat? What have we done? Why have we left the Avengers in this condition? Mm-hmm. You know, what's coming for them? And we began speaking with Marcus and McFeely about it at that time. And I think Marvel at that time is, you know, Kevin Feige, that's when they realized, they asked us to do the Avenger movies. And I think it was because it was such a natural, logical extension of what the work that had been done in Civil War.
So it wasn't a situation where you necessarily lobbied for this movie or pitched for it in a way. It was...
No, it just kind of, it just arose organically from the process of... Working together for
4 years
and
telling the the particular story thread that we were telling.
So it was just an assumption. It was basically like Kevin said, I'll see you guys on Monday at 9 a.m. Don't forget, we're starting Infinity War. Right. Like,
when do we have to have that movie done by?
We have a great relationship with Marcus McFeely. Yeah. We've obviously collaborated with them for almost a decade. And I think to Kevin, you know, Eminem had written other films for them and knew a lot about, as much as anyone did, about the Marvel Universe. And it just seemed like a natural fit. We're almost like a sub-studio, you know, where he could just take the Russos and Marcus McFeely and, you know, say, go, I need two Avengers movies. And they got to wrap up the first 10 years, so
good luck. No pressure. It'll be fine. And you guys, you truly do have a beautiful relationship with Marcus McFeely. Eminem is the first time I've ever heard him referred to as that.
That's our incredible internal code for them.
But you are going to work with him post-Avengers, because you are beginning to... prepare for life post MCU.
That's correct. That's right. We started a progressive studio called Agbo. Mm-hmm. It's a progressive film studio. We got into the film business. We got discovered by Steven Soderbergh at Slamdance Film Festival in 1997.
Yeah.
We made a micro-budget credit card movie out of Cleveland, Ohio. I had zero connections to the film business. And the only reason that we're sitting here talking to you is because of Soderbergh. Because he had the gumption and the wherewithal and the passion to push our careers forward in the business. So we feel like we owe a karmic debt to the universe to now do the same for other people. And, you know, being in a position where we've gotten such profile out of making these movies, it allowed us to raise a lot of capital to start our own studio. Now we're working on projects that, you know, that are personal and passionate to us and to other filmmakers and mentoring them and helping them get their movies made.
It's interesting you say studio and not production company.
I mean, we can write the checks and green light movies. So, you know, we function as a studio.
So in terms of the scope of things, how do you see this operating?
It's specific to us and our taste. And I think when you have an artist driven studio, it has to be. We will do film and television because, you know, the future of the business lies a lot in TV.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, majority of the business will lie in television and digital distribution moving forward. But we tend to gravitate towards three kinds of projects that we've identified: prestige projects. We're working with the Daniels on their next movie after mm-hmm. Swiss, the follow-up of Swiss Army Man.
I love that film.
We're working with Matthew Carnahan on an incredible film, a very powerful emotional story. It's a first time directing. But he's an amazing writer, and category one is prestige genre. Mm-hmm. Is second category, it's elevated genre. You know, we were children of the 70s action films, as you can tell from Winter Soldier.
Yeah,
we're making a film called DACA with Chris Hemsworth at Netflix. That Sam Hargrave, who did all the second unit directing on the Avengers 3 and 4, mm-hmm. will be directing. And that's about a kidnap extractivist going to Dhaka to save the son of a drug dealer from India. So it's a complex movie with a lot of political texture in it. And then our third category is Temple, because we know that, you know, that's going to keep the lights on and it's going to drive it, and it's also, you know, we spent the last 7 years making those movies, so we feel like we understand that space. And we just bought Electric State for Andy Muschietti to direct. And you know, there'll be lots of other projects in that vein. And you know, the next film that we direct will most likely be for our company, and most likely be a tentpole.
And that's the one that Eminem. I'm going to try that forever. Yeah.
I mean, Marcus and McFeely have come on board in a very unique capacity as what we're calling co-presidents of story.
Okay,
we've been developing inside the studio system for many years inside networks.
Yeah,
and we know what works about them, what doesn't work about them, and we're trying to build a better mousetrap. We want qualified storytellers that when you come in to work with us, that we can actually, you know, you don't get the note that says, gosh, we wish it was funnier. We say, here's where it can be funnier. On page 10, when this character says this, you can actually say something, you know, and so we can identify which characters on which pages and help you get through your material quicker at a higher qualitative level because you're working with storytellers who can collaborate with you and help you get out what you want to say faster. So, and because we've spent 7 years working with them, we all have a shorthand, and it's been very effective.
I guess, as you say, that is inspired by how you got into movies in the first place. And your journey over the last 10, 15 years has been really interesting, going from independent cinema, then into, you know, working in television and working in incredible shows like Community and Arrested Development. And then from there, the real escalation is going into the MCU with Winter Soldier and Civil War, and now these two, however many movies you want to make, make another one, why don't you? These two movies as well, and each one is bigger almost exponentially than the last, apart from Avengers 4, which, as we know, is just Tony and Thanos having dinner. Can you talk about what that's been like as directors and going and handling that increase in pressure and scale with each episode?
You know, here's the interesting thing about Joe and I. You know, we've had a very eclectic road as filmmakers. You know, like you said, you know, we've shot movies for no money. We've shot the most expensive films that you can make. You know, and we do television, comedy, drama. We've shot commercials. We're the kind of guys who like to seek out different mediums and different formats because we like how that stimulates us on a creative level. Mm. Like an example is like with Arrested Development. You know, we were the first people to ever shoot a network television show, scripted show in the United States on digital video. Mm. And that was because of very specifically how we wanted to shoot that show, how we wanted to keep the cameras running, how we wanted to stage the comedy in that show. It was very organic to what we were trying to achieve on a creative level. And it gave us a new tool to achieve that by being able to use those cameras. So it's, we like all these different formats. We like how it provokes us on a creative level, and we like the opportunities that it opens to us. So, but at the same time, I would say this road that you're talking about, it feels like for Joe and I, every stage on that road is essentially the same. I mean, we approach everything we're directing, no matter if it's the smallest movie or the biggest movie, the exact same way. You know, you just sit there and say, why do we want to make this movie? What are we looking to do on a creative level? What do we want to say? How can we say that? What's a more interesting way to do that people haven't tried before, etc. That we apply that process to no matter what we're doing. So for us, making movies like this, even though they're kind of seismic in scope, it's kind of the same intimate creative process that we have on everything else.
And do the filmmaking tricks that you used on movies you made for no money or credit card, you know, funded by credit cards, do they come into play on something as big as Infinity War, where you can do anything, but at the same time, are there solutions maybe on a filming day that maybe something's gone a little bit awry that you can use a lo-fi technique?
It's all the same. It is all applicable. I mean, the only place that it differs is like the expense of money that goes to the cast, and then the amount of money that goes to visual effects. But other than that, the set feels pretty much the same, depending, you know, irrespective of scale.
Well, yeah, and that's because, you know, no matter what the scale is, like no matter how much money you're spending on a movie, whether it be $50,000 or $50 million or $500 million, at some point while you're making that movie, you run out of money. It doesn't matter what the budget is. You're going to run out of money regardless. So you basically have the same dynamics no matter what budget level you're at. So.
But yeah, I mean, we've developed techniques over the years. The handheld techniques that we developed on Arrested Development are, you know, the same ones that we use for Winter Soldier. Uh-huh. You know, it's all applicable across the board. You're just, you know, when young filmmakers ask us for advice, we always say, go out and shoot as much as possible. You got an iPhone, shoot.
Yeah.
Post it on YouTube. You got free distribution. But you want to be a great carpenter, you got to build a lot of tables. And, you know, that's been the you know, the main tenet of our careers is that we work, and we work all the time, because we feel like we grow when we work, and so everything that we've done at some point in our careers has come back in some way, and we've developed muscles and techniques that are applicable across the board, no matter what we're working on.
I was lucky enough to be on set of Infinity War for a couple of days and see you guys at work, and it was fascinating watching you work, because from my point of view, it seemed to me that you would do a take, and then one of you would get up and have a chat with the actors and correct something without seemingly talking to each other. Is there a hive mind going on here? What? And then the next take, so you would get up, Anthony, and maybe say something to Downey, and then you do a take again. And then the next take, you, Joe, would get up and do something as well. And you didn't seem to... What the hell's going on? How do you do that?
We have a very efficient communication with each other. Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it so long. We know each other's rhythms. We have, you know, yeah, we can communicate a lot to one another without speaking.
All right.
I mean, we've given thousands of notes over thousands of hours of footage that we've shot and thousands of sets. And it'll literally be to the point where we just take off our headsets after take, and one of us look at the other and go, "You got this," and they go, "Yep." And we get up, and you know, we both, you know, it's a, you know, we have the same sensibility about what is right or wrong about a scene, and typically, you know, if he's got a focus for a scene and he has something he wants to say with it, you know, I could sit there and watch two or three takes and see what develops, and then if I feel like there's something additive, I get up and then I'll start working with the actors, and then that, we, you know, after five or six takes, we have, you know, everything that we could possibly need somewhere in the takes. I think that, you know, a mistake that a lot of directors make or make early in their careers is just, you know, looking for that perfect take. You know, we've learned that, you know, you can build it from seven takes, and
Okay.
You can get, you know, that, you know, the first line in take two, the second line in take four, the third line in take five. You know, as long as you're keeping a running tally in your head of what it is that you want trying to build out of the scene and how you want to craft the performance, you know, it just you can be facile with the actor and with the footage.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it's not like a passive aggressive thing where you'll get up, Anthony, and go, you'll go to, you know, Robert and go, "Play this in a British accent," and then you'll do a take, and you get up and go, "What the hell are you doing in a British accent for?"
Accent. Yeah,
don't do that. That's stupid.
We only do that to actors we want to mess with.
In terms of this movie and going back to the idea of breaking it down, and you know you have. Thanos, and we've talked in the past about how he's going to be an integral part of this film, and you've said he's going to be the main character.
Yeah.
At what point do you know that?
You know, fairly early on. I mean, as you're discussing, look, a big thing with us, because we're fans of these movies, we grew up collecting comics, we, you know, first guys in line for midnight screenings when we're teenagers, you know, what can you bring to the table that's different? How are you going to surprise the audience? And now the movies are so ubiquitous. You know, it's not only do we have to worry about what was done in the last Marvel film, we have to worry about what was done in Deadpool and what was done in DC movies.
Yeah,
and you're looking for, you know, fertile ground to tell a story. And something that we hadn't seen or can't recollect seeing on this large a scale before is a commercial movie told from the point of view of a villain. And we also knew we needed to introduce him correctly into the universe. He hadn't had a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
So in order, you know, the real estate's precious in a movie with 22 heroes in it. We felt like, well, if we ascribe a lot of that real estate to him, then the audience is going to understand it better. They're going to understand what he wants better. You can, you know, weirdly have moments where you empathize with him and other moments where you're going to despise him. And I think that'll make for a more complete viewing for an audience and something that's fresh and different and more surprising.
I think you told me once that Darth Vader was the model in terms of what you're aiming for.
I mean, just having grown up on Star Wars, Darth Vader was always the preeminent villain. And he's complex because he's a tragic character, Darth Vader. So in that regard, you know, I think Thanos is an equally tragic character. He's got a much more vicious agenda than even Vader had. And you know, he's like the Genghis Khan of this universe. He's highly trained. He's fought for a millennium. You know, he's conquered planets. He's fought everyone you can think of. He's stronger than the Hulk. His skin is nearly invincible. He's a sort of, you know, perfect genetic mutation. He's this perfect storm of intelligence and physicality, married to a sociopathic agenda. and our heroes, who are divided after Civil War, you know, going through the middle of a divorce, have to figure out if they can repair their relationships in time to save the universe.
He sounds great. I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. Yeah. He sounds like a really, really cool dude.
Yeah.
But you mentioned there, in terms of your own studio, that you've learned, not just working with Marvel, but working with different studios over the years, what they do well and what they don't do well. What do studios do well and what do studios not do well, in your opinion?
That's a good question. I mean, I think what we believe we can bring to the table unique, and it goes to back to what Joe was talking about earlier. You know, when Steven Soderbergh saw our film at the Slamdance Film Festival in 1997, our very first film, you know, there was nobody that responded to that movie except for Soderbergh. You know, he was literally the one person who said, hey, you guys are doing something really interesting there. I'd like to help you do more of that. So there's a unique opportunity that we have as artists to recognize things of value in other artists that perhaps people who come from more of the business side of the industry can't recognize. And we look at it as our responsibility and also our opportunity to help those people move through the system. Now that we've done it ourselves so many times and know it so well, and through have been able to establish a company that's financed in a way where we can help those people move through the system. So I think that's really the niche that we can provide that's uniquely different from a traditional studio, is we can bring voices and we can bring projects along that may not be recognized otherwise. Yeah. And that's what excites us most. There's
a lot of largesse in the studio system. I mean, it's a corporate structure, it's a corporate environment. You know, I think why Marvel works so well is it's, you know, Kevin. Kevin makes the decisions.
Yeah.
And Kevin talks to you directly every day. And it's like, you want to get things done, you just pick up the phone and you text Kevin. And that makes it very easy to work. You know, there aren't layers and layers of people who can't make decisions because they're trying to predict what it is that their boss wants. You're just talking to the boss all the time. Mm-hmm. And he keeps it very lean for that reason, and it keeps it very efficient and effective. I feel like, you know, our frustration as artists, having worked with studios over the years, is lack of you know, qualitative story brains, you know, in a business about storytelling. And a lot of projects languish in development because there's a lack of clear direction, and there's a corporate structure that, you know, contributes to slowing things down. You know, I know Marcus McFeely, when we were working on them, saying, you know, here's why you guys should, you know, give up your jobs as the highest paid writers in Hollywood to come work with us as co-presidents of story at our new studio. You know, one day, you know, we were working together in Infinity War, and McFeely said, I just read this great article. It's fantastic. You guys should take a look at it. It's really heartbreaking. And I sent it to the team over at AGBO, and I said, I read it and said, we should buy the rights to this. And, you know, 24 hours later, we bought the rights to it.
Wow.
And I emailed McFeely back and said, you know, the next day we just bought the rights. And he said, holy shit. and then, you know, Matt Carnahan, you know, wrote a script that was incredible.
Yeah.
And we greenlit the first draft. That's how good it was. And he's in production right now. So in less than a year's time, we bought the rights to the article, got a script and a director, and the director's in production on the project. It's just efficiency. It's efficiency of storytelling. It's being able to work with the right people and to find the right material and put it together with the right artist and be confident in the choices that you're making and go.
I also think the studios are, you know, the studios, because they are big, huge corporations that have been doing business for decades and decades now, they're very much enmeshed in the, you know, how things have been done traditionally, and the infrastructure that exists for that. And we're in a changing world right now. The media landscape's changing radically. The world is changing radically. And I mean, that's one reason why we got involved with these Marvel movies, is they provided a creative opportunity that has never existed before, serialized storytelling on a cinematic level at this level. And that's the kind of things, you know, we're better able, I think, to move toward ideas, like outside the box ideas like that on a structural level, than a traditional corporation. Even though the studios can get there on their own, they take longer to get there. So I think that's another distinction between what we can do and what a traditional studio does.
And how can you safeguard against being bogged down by the process? and avoiding the pitfalls at other studios, because which probably all started out with the best of intentions to go down the creative road that you guys are going down.
Well, we tried to design the company in a way. We never wanted to get stuck into a place where we had to produce product because we just needed to, you know, for financial reasons or whatever.
We wanted to have a slate. Yeah, you know, it's not a guaranteed number of movies.
We structured the company on an economic level so that we could be very choosy about what we make and when we make it, because we want to be content driven first. And I think there, you know, that's very unusual. Normally, studios get set up from the point of view of a financier who's like, okay, here's the amount of money I'm going to put in. Yeah. I need this many movies released in this amount of time, and then we can make that much money if we, you know, et cetera. That becomes the model for how a studio is going to do business. Mm. And that's totally driven by business, whereas we structured everything to be driven by content. When we find the right projects that we're passionate about, that deserve to be made, then we can move on them. And then the economic model of the company supports that rather than vice versa.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. You're clearly very, very busy. You're focused on Infinity War and whatever Avengers 4 is going to be called. And you've got the studio as well. Do you get a chance to see other films? I mean, you mentioned there, Joe, that you have to be aware of what Deadpool is doing, of what DC are doing. So are you looking at Justice League and going, oh, hang on, there's superficial similarities plot-wise between them and us? How do we make sure
we see some of it? You know, it's just really dependent on time, frankly.
I mean, we see
a lot of it late too.
I would say in the last year, we are voracious. You know, we consume media at a voracious rate, but the past year and a half has been kind of an exception.
We haven't seen much. if somebody points out there's something that's a similarity, I mean, you know, I would just go, well, this is a story that we're interested in telling, and we have different characters, and you know, so we tend not to get caught up in that. You know, we just try to just bear down and put blinders on, which is why sometimes it's good not to see other things. It's there is no corollary whatsoever. Yeah. We did get a chance to see Wonder Woman. Loved it. Kids loved it. Got to see Black Panther in the theater, which was awesome. So it's rare, but we do.
But you're not pivoting based on what you've seen. I mean, for example, I think a lot of people expected the phenomenal success of Black Panther to impact Infinity War directly.
We were already locked picture. I mean, it's like we already made all of our choices. We had an affiliation for Panther because we worked with him on Civil War, and we knew Ryan was going to knock that thing out of the park. And so our expectation was we'd already built a large part of our storytelling around Wakanda and Black Panther. So there was no way to pivot, frankly. I mean, you know, how are we going to do it in 6 weeks before we had to release the movie?
I don't know, just shoot Chadwick on a green screen, right. Just stick him into every frame.
giving a speech.
giving a speech. Or just maybe tucked away behind a sofa. You know, spot the Black Panther in this sequence. That'd be amazing. As ever, it has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much indeed. And look forward to the spoiler special.
Thanks so much. It's
legally
always a pleasure,
legally
Chris,
binding. Legally binding. Brilliant. Joe Anthony.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Take care, man.
Okay, time now for the reviews section of the show. And that was the review section of the show. Thanks very much for joining us. Was there anything to talk about this week?
I think there might be. There's a very good independent film called Beast.
Beast. Should we talk about Beast?
Yeah, probably should.
This is Marvel's Beast. It's the tale of Dr. Hank McCoy.
No. This is Jessie Buckley starring role. She is a young woman called Mole. She was a troubled teen. She still kept very, very close by her parents, especially her very controlling mother. She keeps trying to rebel against this, and one night is out at a club, picks up a guy. He gets a little bit too, you know, aggressive with her.
Yeah.
But he's scared off by a newcomer, played by Johnny Flynn.
Johnny Flynn.
Yes. And she and this guy strike up a relationship, and an uneasy, slight power struggling, is he good for her, is he bad for her kind of relationship. Yeah. And meanwhile, there are murders.
Murders.
Going on the island of young women, and you're worried, can we trust him? Is he safe? Is something else going on? If so, what? It's a bit of a mind game.
Who's the beast?
Who is the beast?
What is the beast?
Indeed.
This is really, really assured stuff. This is from director Michael Pierce. Very much a two-hander between Jessie Buckley and Johnny Flynn. This one will definitely keep you on the edge of your seat, and it's a really low-budget British film, very, very assured, very, very gripping, great performances throughout, and it'll keep you guessing
right up or to or until very near the end. We gave this 4 stars, and obviously it is called Beast, but it's a very tiny beast next to another movie that may be out this week.
What, there's another film?
I think there is another film, and you know, if you're in the mood for something slightly different and maybe supporting British cinema at the same time, then go and check out Beast. 4 stars. Four stars then for Beast. And that is it for this week's reviews section. Definitely now, there's nothing else to talk about.
Maybe check your notes there, Chris. Just make sure that we've covered everything before we move on.
Okay, no, I'm going to just, yeah, just have a quick look here. So, yeah, okay, so we did the question.
Did the question. Yeah.
Premiere thing, that was good.
Interview.
Sky Cinema stuff, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sky interviewed Russo's, movie news. Did we do movie news?
Yeah, we did
movie news. Then we got to the reviews section. Oh, I haven't mentioned... No, that's everything.
Oh, yeah. All right,
cool. Oh, no! Infinity War.
Hooray!
How did I forget? Oh, my word. So, yes, Avengers Infinity War came out. You've probably already seen it, so you've probably already formed your own opinion. We will be doing our own spoiler special in this, Russo and Marcus and McFeely free. But I can say, hopefully, fingers crossed, down the line we'll be able to do something with those guys. But this is, of course, the 19th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and this is where it's all been built into. This is the grand smorgasbord. Siri has just said, I'm not sure I understand. Siri has clearly not read on my watch. I don't know what I've said to trigger Siri, but she said, I'm not sure I understand. Siri, you need to see the previous 18 films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe to really understand. This brings them all together, all of them. Iron Man, Hulk, Star-Lord, the Guardians of the Galaxy, Gamora, Black Widow, the Captain of the Americas, all of them, they're all together. Black Panther, Hulky Damas, that guy, they're all here because they have to stop the strange doctor, Mr. Doctor, that's his name, they have to stop Thanos, who is Josh Brolin in a mocap onesie, from getting the Infinity Stones. And if he gets all the Infinity Stones, then that's Yahtzee, and that's bad for the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And indeed the universe.
And indeed the universe. So that's the story. Join us next week for... And this is tricky because we can't go too much into spoilers.
No,
but,
no, definitely not.
No spoilers.
People who listen to this podcast will know that we have been anticipating this film for quite some time. Did it live up to expectations?
Yes.
It did. I'm going to, as I like to think, I'm slightly more balanced than the two of you in terms of Marvelness. While I like Marvel, I'm not quite as,
you've only sipped the Kool-Aid.
That's
you
exactly.
Quaffed.
I haven't injected it into my veins as you two have. Yes, it does deliver, I think, on every level. There is, and I know reviews on this haven't been, you know, entirely positive across the board, but I thought this was a magnificent film. Absolutely magnificent. So much so, the second the credits started rolling, I texted Disney and said, I want to see it again. I'm coming again tomorrow morning.
What did Disney reply? Did you just text Disney?
Dear Disney. Disney@disney.com. That's what I sent.
Dear Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Okay. Mickey came back and said, fine.
Let this guy in!
I don't know what else this film could have done. I think all of my concerns were that it would be too many people, not enough material to go around, desperately trying to cram in moments for everyone. A villain, I mean, because they have frankly, a very patchy track record, I think, on villains. You know, I worried that so much of this would rest on Thanos, and actually they delivered on all of it. I thought everyone had wonderful moments. I don't think anything felt forced. I thought it was wonderfully paced. I think they cram an incredible amount into 2.5 hours. And I think Thanos is superb. He's an incredibly sort of layered villain. He's sinister, he's powerful, he's intimidating, he's frightening, but he's also very, if not human, then Titan. But he has a sensitivity to him. You understand him, he's layered, his motivation is clear, if misguided. And I really rooted for him, and I think this is...
I rooted for him,
but not in I felt an empathy for him. Like I had sympathy for Thanos. You know, I didn't want to see him die. You know, I wanted to see how he played out. And this is Thanos' film.
So you must have been upset when he gets killed.
when his head falls off. Yeah, that was a very difficult moment for me.
That's a fake spoiler, fake news.
That's not... So many surprises in this. So much stuff that we clearly can't talk about in this particular podcast. But I would say, if you've watched the other Marvel films, you're already going to see this. It doesn't matter what we say. If you've seen no other Marvel films, it will make no sense to you whatsoever.
This is not the Marvel film to start with.
It's 100% third act.
Now, I do think that you don't have to have seen every single one. If you haven't gotten around to Black Panther yet, you're not going to miss that much. That's fine.
I think Caroline Seedy, who listens, and I'm probably mispronouncing your name, surname Caroline, but she actually pointed out on Twitter that the films you should watch, Guardians 1 and 2, Thor Ragnarok, Black Panther and Doctor Strange, they're the five that you really... And Civil War.
Civil War.
Those are the films you absolutely need to see to get a sense of the relationships and where people are in this movie.
Yeah, that's it. It's because there's no introduction to anyone. You are dropped into relationships and scenarios that are already ongoing, and that's absolutely fine. Because as I said, you know, they've had villain problems. I've often had problems with Marvel third acts as well. And yet this is one big third act, and it's like they saved all of the third acts for this film and then just dropped them on your head. It's absolutely incredible. Just the spectacle of it is amazing. So, yeah, loved it. And I know Helen agreed because she was sitting next to me.
Squeeing.
Yes. How much squee did you squee?
All the squee.
This?
It went all
quite,
over me.
Quite a lot, actually. Yeah, there was a lot of clapping at certain moments, and there may have been cheering at a couple of moments, and definitely like punching my sister in the arm, going, "Can you see this? Look at it."
Do you see?
Yeah, basically that. It was. I really had a very good time watching it all three times.
And you established a world record for review writing, turning it around in what, 45 minutes?
About that, yeah.
Which was incredible.
I just think it's so well put together, and that sounds kind of cold. It sounds like I'm kind of damning it with faint praise, but it was like just as a marvel of engineering. This is the Eiffel Tower. Do you know what I mean? This mm-hmm. is one of those bridges across some uncrossable chasm. It is a marvel of engineering, but it is also a really lovely piece of storytelling. There are beautiful little character moments. I think this cast that Marvel has built up over the years, with God knows how many Oscar nominations between them, and just so much charisma that it's dangerous. It's weaponizable charisma, and they all take tiny moments and make so much of them. Okoye being a great example. She is barely in the film. She's on screen maybe for 5 minutes total. Maybe mm-hmm. 10 mm-hmm. at absolute most.
I think that's generous.
And she has like a three of my biggest laughs in the film. Like, she is hilarious. You get that with everybody. Every time it cuts to a different group, I find myself, instead of like when Game of Thrones does that.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones, you cut from the wall to, you know, the King's Landing, you're like, oh, and it takes you a minute to get back into the King's Landing.
You don't want to be taken away from where you were.
Because you were really into what was happening at the wall. Whereas here, it cuts from, let's say, somebody on Earth to, let's say, one of the Guardians. Again, not a spoiler. You're like, oh, cool. What are they up to? And I don't even like the Guardians that much. And yet...
Yeah, I mean, we will dig into this in a lot more detail. Yeah. We have set aside 2 hours for the spoiler special recording session tomorrow.
Let's save it for that. Save it for the podcast.
Save it for the podcast. And who knows if we go beyond that. We'll see how it goes. But do send in your questions if you're here. No, because you'll be hearing this after. Okay, forget that. Anyway.
We've already recorded it. Don't send in anything.
Yes, don't send in anything. Unless, of course, it's money. I will accept money and cake. Look at me, for the love of God.
Your weakness is cake.
My weakness is cake. My weakness is also money, because then I can buy more cake. But I will say very, very quickly on this, I also had a blast with it. But I will say that I can see why this isn't getting across-the-board positive reviews, because it is so dense, and it drops you in. And I think a lot of film critics are going into this not knowing what the hell is going on. And that might ultimately reflect, I think, on, you know, it's why it's not getting across the board raves like Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok did. This is a very, very funny film, but it's also a very, very intense film. It's a very, very serious film, probably the most serious. In the stakes are high. There are casualties? There are casualties. Let's just leave it at that. But all that, I had an absolute blast with it. I don't know that I love it as much as the other Avengers movies. And I realize that I'm pretty much out of whack because I really like Age of Ultron and most people don't. But I need to see it again.
You're seeing it again tonight?
I've seen it again tonight for the spoiler special. But with movies like this, it tends to take me two or three goes round. Didn't love Civil War when I first saw it. Now it's in my top five. Didn't love Black Panther when I first saw it. Now I do. So it does take a little while.
I think sometimes because we go in overhyped, it can be a problem. And I think with, because I want to agree with you slightly, on Age of Ultron and Civil War, in both cases, I felt like I was seeing the gears move. And in this one, I didn't have that feeling so much. I felt like it was smoother. Even though there are 10 times as many gears, you know. So I thought it was better than either of those in that respect. But I can absolutely see that people would have the same criticism because it does have the same issue that they had, which is just so many moving parts.
Yeah. If you are in any way an agnostic about the MCU, this is not the film for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It is a crossover event without crossover appeal.
Okay. Right. But, fantastic. So, but yes, but brilliant.
But
brilliant.
We give it five stars.
Five stars.
Which is very much a recommendation.
It is indeed a recommendation. And that is it. That's it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by Sky Cinema. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We will be joined by the stars of Netflix's The Alienist, Dakota Fanning, Luke Evans, and Daniel Brühl, Simo himself. Simo! Until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye from James.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to clear my schedule ahead of recording the Infinity War Spoiler Special. I've just freed up the rest of April. I suggest you do the same for the purposes of the listening. Thanks very much. Bye.